Please be seated. The second case for oral argument is David Koenigi, appellant versus B&L Food Stores and others appellees. For the appellant, we have Ms. Stephanie Polkup, an attorney from Gregory. And I'll apologize in advance. I'm probably not going to do any better this time than I did last hour. Ms. Kristen M.
Kochakian.
Okay. Duly noted. Redfield for the appellees. With that, Ms. Polkup, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. It is my pleasure to be here today on behalf of appellant and plaintiff David Koenigi. We really appreciate the opportunity to have the court address what is a fairly common issue facing lawyers and clients when a family member has an oral contract with another family member because of the need to help somebody who has a medical or personal crisis. Parties here acknowledge that there was an employment contract that was an oral one negotiated between brothers David and Robert Koenigi, who had a long and close relationship their entire lives. This contract was negotiated some 15 months into an 18-month prognosis to live that Robert had received as a result of a brain cancer diagnosis. And after he had exhausted his treatment opportunities and as his physical health was in decline and he was counting his life in months, not years. It is the terms of the contract that are disputed, and because it wasn't in writing and there's not a dispute that there's not a writing that evidences this agreement, Robert's widow successfully asserted a statute of frauds defense, which was successful at summary judgment. The summary judgment analysis was based on the view that David's employment contract only had two ways of being terminated. The first was his retirement, which would be a number of years. The second one was arguably a shorter period of time, and that would be when Robert's children were old enough to take over the store. This analysis...
That contingency would have also exceeded a year.
Not necessarily, and that's a disputed issue of material fact, because the summary judgment analysis did not take into account the undisputed testimony that Robert has another adult son. And not only does he have an adult son, he has an adult son, Jason, who prior to him asking David to come run the store, Robert himself had hired to manage the Redfield store for him. And he asked Jason to step down when Robert came aboard because he thought Jason was not ready. But unaddressed in the summary judgment analysis is the fact that there is another adult child who actually had managed a store, had stepped down for not being ready, and was working and continued to work at the store when David became the manager. So the that's just one material fact that is unaddressed in the summary judgment analysis. The other one that I also think is determinative and should permit this case to be decided at a court trial is the fact that
court trial. I assume you want a jury.
You know, Your Honor, we basically had requested, we didn't request a court trial in this case. We did consider this equitable relief, specific performance of the term of the contract. That was in my pleadings, and while I do often prefer a jury trial, this one was pled that way, and I think I'm stuck with it.
Thank you.
But the other term that was not addressed in the summary judgment analysis that is based on actual testimony in the record, not speculation, not wishful thinking, but testimony from David Koenigi that when his brother said, my cancer's back, there's nothing I can do about it, and it would be most helpful for you to come here to Redfield where I am and manage this store, that they talked about retirement as a possibility. They talked more likely about the hope that Robert had that his children would one day One of them would run the store, be ready to do that. But more realistically, they talked about, and Robert was the person who raised it, what's going to happen when Robert dies and Lynette, his spouse, is going to be the decision maker in their grocery corporation business? And that was a pretty important issue, and neither one of them predicted long-term employment. In fact, that is the reason that a severance term was even discussed, because they recognized that there were three facts that were pretty important to making people think about severance, and the financial loss that David had calculated from giving up a successful career in state government, the benefits that go with that, a home here, and the opportunity to be the captain of his own ship as the owner of one of Robert's other grocery stores, to move to a small community and actually live with Robert and his wife until he could find a home. And those facts are these, and they are also undisputed. David and Lynette, Robert's second wife, did not get along and had a strained relationship. In fact, Lynette had objected to Robert hiring David. And so the backdrop and the context of this is important, and that is a material fact about why somebody would be discussing severance and very short-term employment. The second fact is that Robert and Lynette had a strained relationship. And a part of the strain in their relationship was the fact that Lynette had selected other parties that she wanted to take over and manage the Redfield store. She had hoped that Robert would hire the Bruns family, who are actually in business in another corporation running another North Dakota store that Robert and Lynette had had. And that was her choice of who would run their flagship out of their three stores. And she fully expected that they would be hired, and Robert had actually seriously considered it. And I think it's telling that one of the terms that he had proposed to them before he hired David was that he would actually buy a lot or build them a house in Redfield to get them to come there. And I guess, and sometimes when you think about it in the context of what we know as judges and lawyers about moving from an area like Pierre to a small community, we know that from Project Rural Practice. You can sometimes have to really sweeten the pot because the economic and social realities are very different in rural communities. And Robert was the person who realized that. And for that reason, when the argument is made, the severance term is just like something he would have never done. There is evidence on the record that he was willing to go a long way to try to get a decent manager into his most important store. But the other thing that is on the record is that Robert and Lynette had actually engaged in divorce discussions. A divorce lawyer had been contacted, and they were at that level of dispute with each other before Robert's health situation deteriorated to the point that it was not material, and they focused on his remaining time instead of their end of their marriage.
Counsel, what does the record say about this retirement term? If this was negotiated 15 months into his 18-month diagnosis, he was still hoping for retirement at some point in the future?
No, the contract was negotiated while Robert was 15 months into an 18-month life expectancy. When he was diagnosed in October of 2011, they gave him 18 months to live. I think he lived 20. But this contract with David was negotiated in January of 2013, and it really was at end of lifetime because Robert had been informed there were no more treatment modalities, no more options for him, and he was starting to lose his eyesight and have serious physical deterioration along with just the diagnosis. Everybody at that time, including Lynette, which is borne out by her testimony, that their divorce proceedings did not proceed because his health was just made it immaterial in that respect. But so there's that backdrop of the request by one brother to a beloved brother to come help. And that's just completely unaddressed in the summary judgment analysis. And again, at summary judgment, the obligation is to view the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, and it's not explained why that third term, which makes sense in the context of these facts and the reasonable factual inferences that surround those facts, should have been considered in terms of the statute of frauds analysis that was conducted. And then, again, we have the fact that the trial court in its summary judgment analysis also took the narrowest scope of the facts to say even the arguably longer term was only meant to apply to Robert's minor children. That is nowhere in the record. It is an inference that has been reached at the summary judgment analysis, and under summary judgment analysis, it is not an inference that can be reached. If the trial court is ultimately going to conclude that, we deserve the opportunity to present witnesses live so the court can judge the credibility of the witnesses and hear the story of this case in full. I do also want to note that there was a second reason that summary judgment was granted in this case, and in our respectful view of the opinion, that the court's analysis of the promissory estoppel or detrimental reliance claim is equally flawed in the fact that it is missing a pretty substantial material fact that was presented on the record. The element that must be established at the outset to carry out a promissory estoppel defense to the statute of limitations defense is that a party has suffered a substantial loss that is economic in nature. And here the summary judgment analysis concluded that David just didn't do that. And so it's not clear, unfortunately, for us why the analysis did not include two different facts that were, again, not matters of wishful thinking or speculation on the record. They are testimony from a party about what the party did and said. And they really are not disputed in one sense. Of course, the question of whether there was this discussion between Robert and David, as David testifies, is a disputed issue of fact. But David himself set his financial loss and calculated it in his own mind when he was negotiating with Robert at $100,000 of what he thought he would be losing financially if he came to Redfield and took this risk of short-term employment with a not necessarily cooperative sister-in-law. The second element of testimony that was not addressed in the summary judgment analysis is the fact that both David and Lynette agree that after she terminated him and they discussed the terms of his severance package, he prepared a sheet for her that showed that he would calculate his losses upwards in the range of $300,000. And it's unclear why that was not considered or analyzed in the summary judgment process here, but it just doesn't make its way into the court's analysis. And those are material facts. South Dakota law recognizes that far less in terms of economic loss is sufficient to sustain a case. I think some of those cases they actually just went and tried the issue. The case that I kind of hooked onto as the most hand-in-hand one is the Sully Buttes case, which is a teaching contract where promissory estoppel was allowed to be litigated, and the amount of financial or economic loss that was on the record was a couple hundred dollars. There's an, I think it's the, let me see, it's the There's another case where the amount of loss is property damages and fence maintenance of about 35-foot of fence over a course of years. And that, too, was sufficient to allow litigation to proceed on an issue of promissory estoppel. So it's unclear, number one, what the standard for substantial economic loss that was being used and how that was applied to David Knigge's testimony, and it's unclear why his testimony at summary judgment as the non-moving party was not included in the decision that he had failed to provide evidence of loss of a substantial loss of an economic nature. I'm sorry. There is, I think, speculation in the summary judgment analysis that says, and just another example of how the facts were not construed in the light most favorable. The summary judgment analysis says there wouldn't be financial loss from the loss of that opportunity to captain your own ship and own your own store up in Oaks, North Dakota, because David's testimony was that the store was in disrepair. Well, first of all, David is a CPA with 30 years experience and has been a high-level manager for the state of South Dakota in a budgeting sense, and is unlikely, you know, just on the inference, is unlikely not to have carefully considered the generous terms to purchase the Oak store in the first place. And more importantly, his testimony was Robert called and said that his cancer was back and David would be most useful to him in Redfield. And then when they looked at it, the store was pretty run down. That fact that it wasn't just the store could never make it, because that wasn't how this started and it really wasn't how it ended, but that was the conclusion that was rather summarily reached. And it is disputed, and it should not be the basis of a summary judgment motion. I don't have anything further. I do have my time reserved for rebuttal, unless the court has any other questions. I have a few minutes. Sorry to be such a lawyer about this, but there was I don't know if it was directly in the opinion, which I've read several times, but can't remember today. But during the summary judgment, we were talking about whether David's move to North Dakota, whether he sold his house, left his job, and moved to Oaks was really eviscerated his claim that he had financial loss from giving up his career at state government and moving to North Dakota. First of all, the record does not establish that he moved to North Dakota. He started working at the Oak store and selling his house and getting out of his state government job using his vacation in November of 2012. And it was January when he was living in a motel and just going back and forth between Pierre and then he actually, because of his brother's offer and his acceptance of this contract, moved into Redfield. And so he didn't move. If anything, that was the first offer that was accepted, and then he got a, if not a better one, certainly a more compelling one to help a brother who really needed it. So I just wanted to add that about that element of proof. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Polka. Ms. Kochekian, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Kristen Kochekian. I represent the appellees in this case, B&L Food Stores and the estate of Robert Knigge. Before us today, there are two issues presented, as counsel had noted earlier. One would be the statutes of fraud issue, and the second is the issue of promissory estoppel. From the outset, I'd like to propose this court that summary disposition tests the factual support for claims by limiting the review to pleadings, affidavits, depositions, and documentation that is provided to the trial court for review. The Supreme Court's task on appeal is determining whether there's a genuine issue of material fact and whether the law was correctly applied. The Supreme Court has held that if there's any basis at all to support the trial court ruling, that affirmance is proper. Importantly, there's a burden on the non-moving party to provide specific facts that a genuine material issue of fact is in fact presented. It can't be merely colorable. It can't be based on speculation. It can't be a mere scintilla of evidence, but it has to be sufficient probative evidence that's not based on conjecture or, again, speculation. And that was recited again in its Hamilton v. Summers. The question today is, what determines if a fact is material? And in the statute of frauds, we generally look to the underlying cause of action and defenses to determine the materiality of a fact. While we do dispute on a fundamental level the framing, the emotionality that counsel has injected into this review, I could go on for 10 minutes regarding the nuances of the relationship between David and Kanigi and Lynette Kanigi and Robert Kanigi and Lynette Kanigi. I don't think that's material here, so I will reserve that for another day, unless I have time at the end. I would like to specifically state that the statute of frauds, at its essence, requires that a oral contract has to be in writing in order for it to be enforceable if it's to last beyond 1 year from the contract's making. That is to combat widespread perjury. It's also to impress upon the parties the importance of putting down those important terms in writing while it's still fresh in the memory. And it's also to protect the parties from someone coming back when someone's passed away or no longer available to dispute very specific expensive terms. They have something in writing to protect them for the court to consider. Therefore, the evidence of contractual performance as defined by the contract terms are at the essence of this argument. And within the statute of frauds and the Harriman case that the court has recently heard, the parties never discussed contractual duration. Therefore, it was kicked back to the fact finder for there to be a further discussion regarding the duration that was intended. Here, we have extensive deposition testimony. As in the case of Traverse versus O'Mara, an employee gave extensive deposition testimony. They were held accountable for that testimony, and the summary judgment was affirmed. Here again, there is no genuine issue of material fact. Performance, as defined by David Kanigi is in his own testimony, was limited to two triggering events, the retirement and the children, in his own words, reaching the age that they could take over. That is specifically referenced in his deposition. He framed the children that would take over as the minor children. To bring in or inject that adult children were in existence is a specific red herring here that the court should be very cautious before they go down that road. Because again, when framing statute of frauds arguments, when looking at a summary judgment level, we are limited to the record. And the record, as preserved by David Kanigi, limits those minor children to children that would be at some point the age to take over. Here, the minor children were 13, 14, and 15. So based on the year the contract's making, that would put us within 3 to 5 years where they could take over and have the ability to, the capacity to contract at 18.
And so that eliminates Jason.
Jason is an adult child. That's correct, Your Honor. And again, David Kanigi had an extensive opportunity at deposition to discuss the terms of the contract. And in his deposition, he states the terms were retirement or until the kids were the age to take over. He at no point ever mentioned the adult children. And I think that is of critical importance here because he had the ability to do so. And in his own words, not the deposition testimony of Lynette Kanigi or some other witness. Of course, there are no witnesses here, but of some other individual. David Kanigi himself narrowly clarified who those children were. Now, again, to go back to Kanigi's definition of what a performance is, it is the appellee's position that there are two triggering events. One is retirement. As Your Honor had noted, the retirement was framed within Kanigi, again, his own testimony at 10 to 15 years As counsel noted, he provided a damages calculation which specifically had the age of 65 in it, which is similar to other cases the court has been presented with. And based on that 10 to 15 year 65 age retirement line in his deposition, we can absolutely know for a fact that that contract was intended to stretch beyond a one-year duration. Again, I've discussed the age of the children taking over, and I would caution the court not to follow that red herring down its path regarding the adult children.
You know, though, what about setting those two contingencies aside? There's still the fact that death was impending here. And it certainly looked like he could end up being terminated in less than a year.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And as counsel's pointed out, David Koenigi is a learned man. He has extensive financial background. He was an executive office at the State Department in his job, and he was cautioned by other people to get it put in writing. If, in fact, there was a severance agreement, if, in fact, this contract did exist, it would behoove Mr. Koenigi to impress upon Robert the importance of getting something in writing. He should have done so. The fact that he did not do so, the fact that if this matter pursued to trial, that we would have no evidence, no writings, no witnesses, absolutely no one available to cross-examine beyond David Koenigi as to the terms, is exactly the type of sword that the statute of frauds and summary judgment was designed to protect.
Yeah, but at the time the contract was entered into, if there was one, had the relationship between David and Lynette already soured?
I don't think it had soured at that point. And you know, the record goes back and forth between how the parties characterize it. Lynette did have a preference for certain people. David didn't have experience in a grocery store industry. But that, again, Lynette had nothing to do with this formation of the contract. David Koenigi has at all times asserted that Robert Koenigi was the only other party to the contract. Lynette was never involved in any of the discussions. All of the discussions between David and Robert regarding the business were between them alone in a car going back and forth, and he specifically testified that all of the terms to the contract were negotiated in one sitting, as the trial court mentioned in their four-page trial memorandum. I again just want to, if I can, pull this back a moment. Regarding the trial court's review of this summary judgment motions, they spent four pages of a memorandum listing out and putting specific references to the record to support their rulings. To argue that they had not given all of these facts adequate thought and had not cited to the record is just not true.
But going back to the termination, isn't it possible or foreseeable that that can happen within 1 year? In fact, it did happen within 1 year.
So it's interesting, Your Honor. The termination argument would itself fail as well. There, in Traverse versus O'Mara, we have held that death is not a contingency that would remove a contract from the statute of frauds. And as well, termination in the court of Marrero, they held that the possibility of termination would also not remove a contract from the statute of frauds. Again, the statute of frauds does not say that it doesn't prohibit the making of contracts. What it does say is that you cannot enforce them. They are invalid. And in Marrero, the court specifically said that the possibility of termination, the possibility of breach of contract or dissolution by any other way in less than 1 year does not make a contract that by its terms could not have been performed, that could have been performed within 1 year. And the Harriman court held that a condition that a contract would terminate in the event an arrangement was no longer profitable was still within the statute of frauds. So under the Harriman court's own holding, even if profitability was as speculative as the possibility of termination, that in itself would not make performance something that would take it with outside the statute of frauds. And again, Traverse versus O'Mara, to continue that point, even if an employee substantially performed what was the agreed upon performance event, that also would not take it outside the statute of frauds. So I believe that termination event, that termination argument fails. If we can,
you know, the rule of those cases, you're stating them correctly, but isn't there a difference between a termination that's specifically contemplated? Those cases deal more with with the situation where a death or a termination happens. It just happens. Here, the evidence seems to suggest that this was specifically contemplated, that she would fire him after the death. And it certainly looks like this was all negotiated because of that.
Your Honor, I would be cautious, and I would ask the court to please review the actual language in the deposition. David Koenigi does, in fact, discuss the severance at numerous times in the deposition, and he always couches it in the terms of if I'm going to work until I retire or until the kids are the age to take over. But if she fires me, in the own pleadings of David, he said that in the event I'm terminated. So again, it was a speculation. Not that anything can't happen. He could have been hit by a bus and passed away the day after they got out of the car and made the contract in oral agreement. He could have, in fact, been fired 11 months and, 10 days into the contract. But that would not have itself completed the performance. What it would have done is it would have defeated the performance. It would have been an intervening event. And that's what the trial court focused on. They focused on Koenigi's own language. And he had two triggering events that were to complete performance. And the idea that death or termination, how that would have impacted the contract, it would have been intervening. It would have defeated, but not completed. And I think that is our entire argument as far as the import of that termination language. And we take that language in a light most favorable to Mr. Koenigi. We are using his own language in the deposition. We are using his own documents that he submitted to the trial court for consideration. We are looking at his pleadings that he himself submitted. To look at the pleadings, Your Honor, Koenigi identified five specific terms of employment. Two of those were to occur on an annual basis. Therefore, we have something occurring from year to year. The other two terms were for long-term intent to remain employed, looking for a home, purchasing a home in Redfield, a future business venture in Redfield. And then the final one is the severance package. And the severance package, again, specifically in the language of the pleading itself, is in the event I'm terminated. It does not contemplate that that would actually happen. And again, I would impress upon the court that if this was such a concern, that it behooved Mr. Koenigi to get it in writing. That's the import of the statute of frauds. There is a great risk here to the appellees if this pursues to the trial court level. And that is that there is absolutely no way for them to combat perjury at this point. There are no other witnesses. There are no other writings. Mr. Koenigi has given extensive deposition testimony. Now counsel is saying that he needs to have the opportunity to present live testimony, that somehow this live testimony will allow him to get another bite of the apple, to allow him to further clarify what he meant. But isn't that in fact where perjury could be born? Isn't that in
fact? Is that what cross-examination is for?
But what do we have to cross-examine him with? We have no other witnesses.
And the deposition.
We have the deposition, but he can also provide, he wants to clarify what his intent was. I think out of the mouth of babes and out of the mouth of the first time someone revisits an argument, that those are his words that should be held. At the summary judgment level, again, not that trial wouldn't have a result that would come out in favor of the Koenigis, Lynette Koenigi. But in the sense that at the summary judgment level, we are limited to the depositions. And that is what the trial court based its argument on. And that's what the court is left with to look at the record. And Mr. Koenigi specifically used very, very telling language whenever he framed these individual arguments.
When I read Berger's decision, I didn't see where he ever analyzed this death, impending death factor. He looked at the children. He looked at the retirement. But it's almost like he overlooked this third contingency.
Your Honor, I thought Judge Porter had viewed the death contingency, and I would need to review that in order to give you a better answer.
I think he acknowledged it in the opinion, but when he came to the analysis, I only remember reading his analysis of two of those three factors?
Well, he relied upon Harriman. You know, in Harriman, the parties were completely silent as to duration, and summary judgment was still affirmed for them. You know, at the end of the day, death would be an intervening event. Nowhere in Mr. Koenigi's pleadings did he ever say that death or that termination was part of the contractual performance. He initially at the trial court level framed this as a death contingency. Tellingly, now at the appellate level, now that the appellate briefs have been submitted and we are here before you today, it is now a termination argument that there was an ability for her to fire him. So while the goalpost keeps moving, I think at the crux of it, the game is still the same. This is still a performance issue. And we look at the terms of the contract. All of the terms were for an annual performance. The damages calculation was based on a retirement age that was well beyond 1 year. The children contemplated were too young to have taken over, but he said they had to reach the age before his performance would be completed. So again, even if death occurred, even if allegedly there was a severance package that was contemplated, there's nothing in writing to prove that, and Mr. Koenigi always broached the severance argument in his depositions conceptually apart from the terms of the contract. He says, that was the terms. I'm going to move to Redfield. I'm going to take over the store until I retire and the kids take over. That was the terms. And then we talked about if she fires me. And then we talked about what if she wants to let me go. So as the statute of frauds is a tool to look evidentiary in nature, it serves to remove the uncertainty that a lot of the courts are faced with when these oral agreements are presented to them. And again, it's a sword that's used to protect parties that cannot, they could cross-examine David Koenigi, but they have absolutely no ability to talk to Robert Koenigi, and he's the only other party to this matter. And importantly, and I think critically, is that David Koenigi substantially benefits if this agreement comes out in his favor. So I think that there is absolutely concern and caution to be held there.
I don't mean to cut you off, but I would like to hear what you have to say on the promissory estoppel, and you're running out of time.
Yes, Your Honor. For the promissory estoppel argument, at the trial level, Mr. Koenigi discussed him selling his home and giving up his job. I'd like to, as the court did in the trial memorandum, discuss the actual dates. Mr. Koenigi sold his home. It is undisputed that he did so in November. He did it to move to Oaks, North Dakota. When he went to Oaks, North Dakota, he specifically said, again, he clarified the condition of Oaks, North Dakota as having 40% inventory that was outdated, the equipment was bad, the parking lot had to be replaced, and there was too much in resources in order to invest it. He says specifically that he and Robert jointly decided to scrap the Oaks agreement, and then he moved to Redfield. I'd like to say that in his deposition, he points out the job he gave up was $68,000. As the trial court decided that they looked at the deposition, that the job at Redfield was for $70,200. So what the trial court decided was he actually traded up. He was he made a bad deal. He was trying to mitigate his damages. He was faced with a deteriorating store, and in order to save himself, he took a better deal in Redfield with a better economic environment. It was a conscious choice that he made, and he did that, and that was favorable to him. And again, that's using his own deposition language. So while there may be the idea that he wanted to captain his own ship and he wanted to forge ahead in Oaks, North Dakota, the point is when he got to the ship had a hole in it. And in order to fix the leak, he had to go to a different port. And that is what happened in Redfield. And he was terminated in Redfield, and he did that consciously. He consciously chose to move there. So, again, we would ask that the court affirm summary judgment on both counts. The record is expansive. There are four depositions, exhibits. There's a four-page trial court memorandum, and it provides insight for the court's ruling. And in a light most favorable to Mr. Koenigi, this was a contract that was intended to continue for an unspecified term of years, well beyond 1 year from its making, and tied to contingencies other than Koenigi's lifetime, and which did not take into consideration or at that time factor any type of termination. That was viewed as an intervening event that would defeat performance, not complete it.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Pocup, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. It does matter here what the terms of the contract were, because the statute of limitation or of frauds applies if the agreement by its terms cannot be performed in a year. And we have a very material dispute of fact about what the terms are. We have a fundamental one, which are there two ors or three that make up the terms of this contract? And we do know Robert, in his lifetime, was a forceful person. He was used to doing and running his businesses, even though they were, Lynette was also a part of them. Robert made the decisions. Robert had the authority to hire, to negotiate, to fire, to borrow, to buy, sell, with, all without her involvement. And that is the way they run their business. And we also know that she overheard the some of the contract, just by chance, overheard the contract negotiations before before David moved to Redfield and took the job. And we also know he did move to Redfield, he did take the job, and he did fully perform until he was terminated. It makes a difference if it's three ors, retirement, or a child, or termination that is contemplated at the time that the contract is entered into because of the circumstances between the party. And in this case, in that respect, this case is different than all of the cases that have been cited about the statute of frauds in employment context. Harriman, it's a plaintiff alleging permanent employment and the defendant alleging a term of years. And so the parties are in agreement that the term of the agreement that they're litigating about is more than a year. And in that case, additionally, the plaintiff quit before a year and then tried to seek the damages for the permanent employment loss. Traverse, the plaintiff admits that the term of the contract was at least a year. It could not be performed in a year. It was a year and a month. And again, in that case, the plaintiff quit and sought to enforce the longer term of the contract. In Marrero, the Michigan case cited by the defendants, in that case, the plaintiff agreed and conceded that there was a three-year term. All of those cases are very specifically have by their terms are going to be affected by the statute of frauds. That is not the situation that we have here. We have not one, but two different facts which can take this case completely out of the statute of frauds analysis. And at summary judgment, in particular, the facts must be construed in favor of David Koenigi, not the moving party, and they weren't. The trial court specifically adopted the defendant's position, even though there were other facts, not speculation, not what if this could have happened, but direct testimony that said, Robert and I talked about it. In fact, David testified, Robert brought it up and said, what will happen after my death if you have to work with Lynette and she wants to get rid of you? And neither of them wanted to saddle Lynette with an employee that she might not want to employ. And that is the reason that a severance package was negotiated. I think when we talk about the death contingency, we're looking at it in the context of like Harriman when they were talking about, well, the employee could die, which wasn't a contemplated factor. And I mean, it could happen to any of us today, but that was certainly not one of the factors that went into the consideration. Here, unfortunately for everybody involved, Robert's death, the death of the supervisor, the death of the person with the authority to hire and continue employment, it's not disputed. Everybody knew it, and it had affected all of these parties' lives. It affected Lynette's decision to proceed in divorce actions, and it affected David's decision about whether to stay in state government, whether to try to have his own grocery store, or whether to move to Redfield and move in with his brother. We're just talking about a different death, and the death contingency in Harriman is not applicable because Harriman is, it's kind of a right hand and a left glove in terms of the party's discussion of the terms of the contract. There was a specific discussion that Lynette was soon to be David's boss. And as Justice Severson pointed out, it wasn't just predictable. It actually happened. And David was in full performance of his contract. She had the ability to terminate his employment, and there wasn't any limitation on her ability to do that, and the parties knew that. And that's precisely why people want to have a severance agreement if you're going to make a major life change and move your whole life over to Redfield. Again, we have the same assumption about this when we talk about the kids. There is no specific naming of kids. And in fact, Robert not only hired his own adult children to manage his grocery business, Jason in particular in Redfield, he'd also hired several of Lynette's adult children to run the Redfield and Oaks store. And so this was hiring adult children to run his stores, regardless of their background, was completely consistent with what Robert would do. And I guess that's my final point. I do want to say that we dispute that it is a benefit to David Koenigi to have been fired by his brother's widow after his brother's death and after this move. There are very few employees who would ever consider such a circumstance to be a benefit. And David, I don't think it can be easily disputed, since David believes that his loss ranges in the hundreds of thousands of dollars from that loss of opportunity. It's certainly a disputed fact that that's a benefit. But the argument that that this is an opportunity for perjury, frankly, the facts pointed out in the defendant's brief are, as opposed to perjury, are topics that are contemplated and occur every single day in court trials and jury trials across the state of South Dakota, and some of them occur in depositions, but not all of them. And some of it is about hearsay. And there are a variety of different ways that you can prove by context, by past behavior, by other witnesses and what their experiences are. For example, the experiences of the Brunses, the people that Lynette was trying to recruit to come from Robert's North Dakota store to come down to Redfield, and what their experience was with Robert. There's a lot of ways to do this. And the goal for all of us is to be able to, if there are facts and we do not agree upon them, and I think we do not agree upon the material facts or even the basic terms of this agreement here, when they are there, the goal is to be able to present that testimony live so that the court has the opportunity to see it, not in an extensive deposition and pages of record, because I believe that every justice on this court knows that the record is often very different than what the testimony looks like when it comes out live. And that's all that David Koenigi is requesting here. We respectfully viewing the facts and the reasonable inferences and the facts that support those inferences, not just from David's testimony, but from Lynette and David Bruns and Lisa Bruns' testimony as well on this record. We request that the case be remanded, reversed, and remanded to the trial court for a trial on these issues, so that the plaintiff can have a full opportunity to present this case. And I feel very certain that it will be subject to spirited cross-examination at that time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes, and then we'll conduct our rules hearing.